Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bardrovics. Joining me today is Egon von Greyers from Gold Switzerland. He's the founder and managing partner of Matterhorn Asset Management. How are you today, Egon?
I'm fine. Hello from Switzerland. I'm right now in the Swiss Alps, and I'm good. You know, we have to accept the circumstances we're under now, and it's a tough time not being able to move around, but still, we have to make the best of it. So I'm lucky. I'm all right. Thanks.
That's excellent to hear, Egon. And I share that sentiment, as this is probably the longest I've gone without being on a plane for many, many years of my life. But, you know, we have to deal with the circumstances as they are.
Yeah.
One of the places I'd like to start, Egon, is an article you wrote in August. And you wrote it with the theme of the David Bowie song, Ground Control to Major Tom. And central banks have basically lost all control, is what the major point of the article was. So could you tell us a little bit more about how they have lost control and the economy is really just reeling from these effects?
Well, you know, I'm very interested in history. So what we're seeing now is not new at all. And unfortunately, most people, most students of markets or life, you know, they always think that it's different today because they live it right now and it's always different. But it isn't, because we can go back thousands of years. We can go back to the Roman Empire. And, you know, there are regular periods when governments reach the point when they're spending more money than they're actually receiving in taxes and other fees. And therefore, they're running deficits. But governments cannot accept that these deficits should be present. And because the consequence of deficits is that the people are not getting enough of whatever they want, services or food or whatever. So the bankers or central bankers or governments therefore start printing money to make up the difference. And that happens regularly and has happened throughout history. And that is why throughout history, no money has ever survived, because every currency goes back to its intrinsic value of zero, as Voltaire said. So that is a totally normal phenomenon. But nobody realizes that it's happening today also, because governments that are, you know, our governments now, or take the US governments, which is the biggest economy in the world, they're not telling the people that since the central bank was formed in 1913, the Fed, the dollar has lost 97-98% in value in real terms, which real terms means against gold. But even actually since 71, when Nixon took away the gold backing, the dollar is down 98%. And in the US, I mean, the US economy is totally disastrous for the simple reason that they haven't had a surplus, a real surplus, since 1930. They've been running a budget deficit since 1930. There were two exceptional years in the 40s and the 50s where they had small surpluses. The surpluses declared at the end of the 90s during the Clinton days were not real surpluses. They were just took some below the line money and put it above the line. But the debt continued to go up in the Clinton years. So there were the deficits were real deficits. So this is, you know, this is the history, and this is what's happening every time. And now we're getting into the final phase of this. And of course, at the final phase, you have then the accelerated money printing, and it is then becomes exponential. And we know is now we're almost in the super exponential phase now. Not quite, because we're not got to the inflationary, hyperinflationary money yet in the way that we are measuring it, i.e. in consumer prices. We, of course, have already massive inflation in asset prices, but nobody measures that because I think... So what's happening now, as we both know, that this money now that governments are just... The 2006 to 9 period was a period when the banking system should have gone under, because it was, as we know, only a few minutes from actually going under. But, you know, the Fed is owned by and controlled by private bankers for the benefit of private bankers. So they obviously, these private bankers could tell themselves, because they're on the board and shareholders, they could tell themselves, i.e. themselves being the Fed, you know, we got to save the system. So we got to print another few tens of trillions to save the system. And they did that. I mean, it's surprising that they did. But the world wants to believe that the emperor has got clothes, because it suits the world for as long as they can, you know. And so therefore, you know, the world accepted that all of this printed money actually had a little bit of value, and therefore it continued for another 10 years, which is quite amazing. But now we're there again. And this recent problem was not caused by the coronavirus. The reason for it was already, dates back at least to the beginning of this century, as I said, and the previous crisis and the debt levels and the deficit levels. And we got the first warning signs in August, September last year, with the repos and the accelerated money printing, both the Fed and the central banks around the world, ECB, et cetera, when they both declared we will do whatever it takes, because problems in the system started already then, but nobody told us exactly what they were. And then, of course, the final stage of a crisis is very often the catalyst for the final stage is always something unexpected. And the catalyst here, which was not the reason for it, but the catalyst was the coronavirus, which couldn't have hit at a worse time because the banking system was already in a total mess and central banks were panicking. So therefore, now we've entered that final phase, but the system is still looking at liquidity means higher asset markets. So all of that money is going to the asset markets now, and they're being held at an incredibly artificially high level. And that will be the case until they collapse, and that's going to happen.
And I think one of the very important points that we really need to understand here is that with every billion or trillion that's printed into existence, it's worth less and less, right? And when you combine that with negative real interest rates, how much longer do you think the US can kick the can down the road for before that day of reckoning comes? It really seems like a vicious circle, as the more money you print, really the less value it has, correct?
Yes. Well, I've been talking about this and writing about it so many times that, basically what the central banks are doing, and also the banks, of course, because the banks by extending credit doing the same thing, and the central bank, when they are, they're just pressing buttons and creating money out of nothing, out of thin air. And, this money has zero value. But as I said before, the world wants to believe that it has some value. And of course, the people who stand nearest the printing press are the ones who can use it first because it still has it. This is what President Mugabe, for example, did in Zimbabwe. He got the first printed money, first worthless printed money, and he quickly either spent it whilst it still had some value or he changed it to dollars. And then once it reached that money turned over a few times, then when it reached the people, it had zero value. So, my point is that money that is printed or created out of thin air without any labor, or any production or any exchange of goods, that money is worthless. Now, we are in this euphoric final phase of monetary system where people want to believe that this has value. So therefore, it is just basically pumping up all the asset markets, the stocks, or the bonds and the property market. And that can only last a limited time because at some point there will be some little boy who says, well, the emperor is naked after all, and then the whole thing will collapse. How long will that last? I don't know. It's lasted for a lot longer than I expected. I thought already 2006-09 that, this is the beginning of the end, but it wasn't. It was still the end, but it took a lot longer than I expected. The way we look at the world and the way we look at markets is from a point of view of risk, not from the point of view of trying to time markets and, get in at the bottom and out at the top, because nobody can do that. So you're looking at risk. And we are saying now that the world is now at a point when risk is at an absolute maximum. And this, at some point, the world will discover that this printed money has no value, which means, of course, that all the assets that were bought by this printed money has no value either, or much, much less value than today. So therefore, you will see, obviously, at some point, an implosion of the debt, an implosion of all the assets that were backed by the debt. Now, if people hold assets free and clear and have no debt on them, they'll still have the assets like a property. But, the way I look at the world is that I think in real terms, and I always look at real terms to me is against gold, because gold is the only money that has survived in history and which represents a stable purchasing power. And, that an ounce of gold buys a good suit for a man today like it did 2,000 years ago, basically. And therefore, in gold terms, as I said, all of these, what I call bubble assets, stocks, bonds, and property, are going to go down at least 90 or 95%. People think you are prophet of doom and gloom when you say that. But remember, the stock market in the US in 1929 to 32 went down 90% under financial and economic circumstances, which were nowhere near as bad as they are today. And today is global, I have to remember. Before it was, you know, a few countries in the West. Now it's every country in the world. So therefore, I would expect a fall of markets and of asset prices, which will be much greater than, for example, 1929. Now, as I said, I'm not a pessimist. I just look at the risk. And therefore, the way I look at risk is to, yeah, that is what could happen and is likely to happen. Don't know exactly when. It's no use trying to forecast, you know, when is the stock market going to peak? When is the gold going to, you know, go up further, et cetera? We know the trends are clear and we know the risks are clear. And that's what we have to protect ourselves against, not trying to time the market. You know, this is not a time for trading in and out. This is a time to prepare yourself for wealth preservation.
Well said, Egon. And it kind of reminds me of something one of your friends has told me before, Ronnie Stofferly, telling me that we should leave the bottom picking to the proctologists, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so, absolutely.
There's another important thing that you said in there about the repo crisis last August to September. And you were saying that it was as important as the 1971 event where Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard. So could you tell us a bit more about why that was such an important event that nobody really recognized yet?
Yes, to me, that was a seminal event, August, September last year, because, you know, to me, the risk was already very elevated since, as I said, since 2006-09. You know, the global debt has doubled since 2006. It was about 125 trillion in 2006, and it's around 270 trillion today. And of course, remember before that, in the late 1990s, it was 80 trillion. So, you know, debt is growing exponentially. And, you know, the signals that the central banks were giving in August, September last year, both the ECB and the Fed, were such clear signals that the system is now on the point of breaking and we will have to give it all it takes. We will print whatever amounts of money that is necessary in order to support the system. We know, of course, that this is going to, in the long term, is going to be a losing game. They managed in 2006-09. Now, as I said, debt has doubled since then. But if debt doubles, risk goes up exponentially. We have to remember that. And that is exactly where we are now. So risk is much greater. And on top of that, we have now a world which is locked down or closed down to a great extent. And you go to city centers in the world, you know, you go to the city in London, the financial district, or you go in New York or San Francisco, you know, they're dead, these city centers. And of course, some companies are still functioning. Of course they are. But overall, you know, it's an absolute disaster. So, but still we have this massive disconnect between economic reality and markets. And that disconnect has grown bigger now since the corona crisis started. But at some point that will collapse. It doesn't have to collapse today. You know, there's still this possibility of a final hooray, you know, i.e. a melt-up or crack-up boom, as von Mises called it in The Austrian Economist, which means that, you know, this printed money, the euphoria continues, people disregard all the economic realities, and they just buy more assets, financial assets. And, you know, I said in one article that it's possible that the Dow doubled from 25 to 50,000. And in the next year or so, it's possible. It's not a forecast and the risks are enormous. And I would certainly not bet on it. And I wouldn't put any money on it, but it's possible. But it's also possible that, you know, in similar period that gold and stock markets reach a 1-to-1 ratio, which where they were in 1980. 1980, gold was $850 and Dow was $850. So if the Dow goes to 50, the gold might meet the Dow at 50. But remember, if the Dow doubles from 25,000 to 50,000, then gold has to go from 2,000 to 50,000, which is up 25 times. So I know where I would put my money. I would put my money in a wealth preservation asset that certainly insures me from this risk that I'm looking at. And whether, because the risk is also that the stock market collapses from here. And therefore, to me, that's not a good risk. 50,000 or collapse, I'd rather be in gold, which is likely to continue to go up strongly.
Yeah, and I think the risk part of that equation in the DAO is something that really needs to be highlighted. And I think all of our listeners, you know, really understand that. But if we talk about that one-to-one DAO to gold ratio, that is definitely much riskier on the one side than it is on the gold side. One of your really good presentations that I went through in preparation for this interview was called The Dark Years Are Here. So something that I'd like to get a bit more of your thoughts on is if we could see a debt implosion and how big is the derivative problem as part of this?
Yes. I mean, the dark years are here. I wrote the first time in 2011, I think. So although, you know, that I was a bit early, but again, I look at risk. And of course, from the point of view of gold, we've been into gold since 2002 at $300, and we never sold anything, and our investors are continuing to buy. So therefore, we've been right on the trend of gold and on the risk in the system. But, you know, we did expect that it wouldn't last as long as it has. But the dark years are here, as obviously they're alluding to the dark years after the fall of the Roman Empire. And so that was around 500, just before 500 AD, when the Roman Empire fell. And then you had a period of about 500 years of economic downturn, cultural downturn, mainly throughout Europe. It was obviously a bit, also, I mean, obviously the Roman Empire stretched a bit further, but it was really Europe that was most affected. Now, you know, this wasn't a catastrophic fall from one day to the next. It was just a gradual decline in the whole of the ex-Roman Empire. And of course, the Roman Empire was exactly in the same situation as we are now. You know, at one point, which was a bit earlier, their currency, the denarius, collapsed by 90%. And that was measured in the way that the denarius was a silver coin, and it had almost 100% silver at the beginning, and at the fall, at the bottom, it had just over 0% silver. So they had other metals instead, copper and zinc and stuff. And then, you know, so the dark ages was a period of decline. Now, have to remember, I think we are getting to that point now also, that because I think this is the end of a major era. Now, if we look, and only the historians will know afterwards if this is the end of a 200-year period since the early 1700s, or it goes for a lot further back since from the, you know, the Roman Empire time. It doesn't really matter. You know, I think we are at the end of a major cycle, and that will be written about in history books afterwards. So if we now get this debt implosion, which, remember, you can never solve a debt problem by issuing more debt. That is obvious to anyone, except for the governments and central bankers who are pretending that they can just print more money and they create a new principle or a new name for it, whatever you want to call it, Keynesian economics or MMT or whatever. But it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. The world cannot live on printed money that has zero value. If we could, you know, why don't we all live in Shangri-La, you know, print unlimited amounts of money, stop working, stop paying taxes, et cetera, and we just print money. I mean, that's the consequence of what we're doing today. But no one wants to admit that, of course, that that's the situation. Everybody believes, well, we know, we're going to sort it out. This debt problem and this debt bubble is not going to survive. It has to implode. And by imploding, it's the only way that the world can continue to grow, because you have to, you know, you have to get rid of all the excesses, get rid of all the debt, and start again with green shoots. That's the only way to have a sound platform for the world to continue to grow again. So that will be a period, that will be the dark ages. Now, how far will it go? I don't know. But the risk is, let us say that, you know, governments lose control, the debt implodes. And of course, initially they print unlimited amounts of money. You get the hyperinflationary stage and you get high interest rates. You know, I've been through high interest rates. I mean, I lived in the UK in the 70s, and my first mortgage went up to 21% in 1973, I think it was. And so, you know, high interest rates, that's inevitable. Everybody believes that the central banks are going to keep the interest rates low. And that's absolute nonsense. They can't. They will lose control of the market, the central banks, because as they print more money and as the currency collapses, remember, hyperinflation always arises as a result of currency being debased, not as a result of higher prices or anything. It's just the currency that collapses. So that is going to happen. And then the debt will implode. Interest rates will go up, you know, to some of it If the debt is worthless, interest rates will be infinity, of course. And then if that happens and governments basically lose control of society, then, you know, that there is no, there will be no money to pay for social security, pensions for government employees, etc. So the fabric of society will hopefully not totally disintegrate, but it will certainly be fractured, badly fractured. And therefore, you know, when a lot of people will lose their jobs and economic activity will come down to a totally different level. Now, the way I see the world, that's inevitable. And again, I'm not a pessimist. You just have to look at the consequences of the risk and the system with all this money. Now, the final stage, coming back to your question of this, is also that on top of the global debt of 270 trillion, you know, there are obviously the unfunded liabilities of another few hundred trillion around the world. And then you have derivatives, which at least in my view are 1.5 quadrillion and could be a lot more. And the BIS, Bank of International Settlement in Basel, they report a lower figure because from one day to the next, they just halve that figure. They halve the derivatives. So they're reporting a lower figure. But I think the real gross figure is certainly at least 1.5 quadrillion, maybe more. Of course, everybody, all the banks talking about, well, we net it off and the net is a lot less. And that's the real risk. That's nonsense. When counterparty fails, which is always the case in the debt crisis, gross debt remains gross. And therefore, so you have, let's say, 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives, which will also implode. Remember, they back every single financial instrument in the world, these derivatives. And they're also very much based, you know, a link to interest rates. When interest rates go up, which they will do, these derivatives will implode just because of interest rate change. So in my view, central banks will also have to print enough for that 1.5 quadrillion. So, you know, if you have debt of 500 trillion and derivatives of 1.5 quadrillion, you'd maybe talk about 2 quadrillion or more in money printing. And of course, that's what would give us hyperinflation and collapsing currencies and all of that. Of course, I wish I'm wrong. Of course, I wish that this is just fantasy figures. But, you know, it is the way I look at it. That's the economic reality. And that's the risk. And that's the risk that investors should be prepared for. Nobody is, of course. Nobody is. And if you look at what we are trying to help investors with is to preserve wealth in the form of physical precious metals, you know, held outside the banking system. Now, only 0.5% of world financial assets are in gold. And, you know, so therefore, nobody holds gold. No, virtually no individual, no institution, no asset manager. They don't hold gold because they don't understand it and they don't know what it is for. And, you know, all of these people managing money, they don't like it either because they can make no money on it because they prefer to churn commissions and issue their own funds, et cetera, where they can charge 5% up front or whatever. So, you know, I see that there's the risk of the dark ages, as I'm calling it, I think are very high. And, you know, it's going to be a different world. But, you know, we shouldn't believe that's the end of the world. The world always goes on. I often take the example of old institutions like, say, Eton, there's a school, a very famous school in England, a boarding school where you know, a lot of prime ministers, including Boris Johnson and many others, have gone to. And, you know, that has been around for, you know, over 550 years through wars, through depressions, through revolutions, etc., and has survived. And just like institutions survive, the world will survive also. It's the period of transition which will be tough because a lot of people will have very difficult times and because there'll be lack of food, lack of money, etc. But then they're just like during the Dark Ages, which didn't go that fast because they didn't have the debt bubble in the 500s or the 2000 AD. But, you know, it'll be just a gradual process and the initial will be tough and then everybody will adjust to a different standard of living. We don't need iPhones, iPads, 2 cars, 5 televisions, traveling, you know, going on holiday 5 times a year, et cetera. We don't need all of that. The world was fine. You know, I was brought up, you know, when I was young in Sweden, when I was born, you know, I don't think we had a television until I was 16 because that was, you know, nobody did. And, you know, life was better. I would say that the quality of life was much better than it is now with all the gadgets that we have. So we will have to learn to live without all of this and suffer a bit during the period of transition. And then we adjust to just a lower level of of spending. And that's, you know, happiness is not things or material things. Happiness is, you know, like right now, I'm in the mountains, you know, the nature. Nature is fantastic. That's free. Everybody has access to nature somewhere. That's absolute. That's happiness. Happiness is being with other people and talking to other people, having friends, having family. That's happiness. Books, music, that's all free. So we don't need all these gadgets. We don't need all this entertainment on television, all these excesses. So in one way, I think the period that's coming, except for the transition, is going to be a good period for mankind, because we'll come back to real values instead of all these golden calf material values. So in one way, as I said, I think it'll be good for the world, but it'll be tough. The first period will be very tough.
Agreed, Egon. I think one of the very interesting charts that you had in that same presentation as well is the value of gold adjusted for the U.S. money supply. So could you tell us a bit about where that value is at the moment for a reference level?
Yes, I think that's an extremely interesting chart. And of course, nobody looks at it really generally. So if you measure the gold price against the U.S. money supply, and then, you know, the gold price today at, you know, $1,900 is exactly the same against money supply as it was in 1971 when gold was $35, and as in 2000 when gold was just under $300. So in relation to money supply, gold is now at an absolute bottom, which means that the gold price today has not reflected the massive money printing that's taken place. This is just in the U.S. It's U.S. money supply we're talking about, but it would be the same for global money supply also, especially in the Western world. So that is, you know, gold relatively is incredibly cheap today, or undervalued. And therefore, you know, so we've been in gold since $300, 2002. In a major way as a company and helping investors. But, you know, gold, if you look at it from that point of view, gold today is as cheap as 2000 when we paid $300 for it. And therefore, you know, nobody should believe that they're getting in at a high price today, because this is gold is still a bargain and is in no way reflecting what's happening in the financial system. So it is definitely not too late to buy gold, because the real move in gold is just starting now, in my view. Remember that gold has just reached that 2011 high of $1920. We just reached that now in dollars, but in all other currencies, gold has gone way above that 2011 level already several years ago. So it's just that the dollar has been a little bit stronger. Therefore, the gold in dollars has lagged behind. But that's going to catch up now, as the dollar also, which I expect, the dollar is going to fall dramatically in the next few years. And you know, investors should think about, when you measure your wealth in a currency that is continuously being debased, and you take the dollar as an example, you're kidding yourself. You know, you're measuring it against something that is losing value every day. I mean, as I said, it's lost over 80% this year, the dollar in real terms against this century against gold. So, you know, don't measure your net worth or your wealth in something that has no relevance. Measure it against gold instead. And that's why you see what's happening to your wealth. So, yeah, that gold is in relation to what's happening in the financial world and the money printing is extremely cheap today.
So you speak a lot about gold. Egon, what value do you think silver has in somebody's portfolio?
You know, for quite a long time, we told investors, if you want to sleep well at night and you really own a wealth preservation asset, own only gold. Because, and of course, we started 2002, as I said, and gold in those days went from $3-4 up to $20, down to under 10 again, up to 50, down to $12, and then up to 50 a second time and down to $12. So the volatility, you know, is not for normal people, not for widows and orphans, because, you know, you won't sleep at night with silver. Now, when we have, so we told investors already then, the maximum, if you want silver, but you don't really need it, you're going to make enough money or protect enough wealth with gold. But if you want silver, don't own more than 25% of your total precious metal assets. Now, we've seen a different situation now, because the gold-silver ratio, which is the gold price divided by silver, you know, was up to almost 130. In latter years, it's been around, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80. And of course, the historical average is 15. i.e. gold divided by silver, 15. So we are still now, you know, in the 70s gold-silver ratio, which has come down from 130 to 70. So silver is still at a very good price in relation to gold. And so therefore, it is likely that silver will be at least reaching the 9 to 2011 level, which was 30. So we were down to, when gold went to $1,900 the same year, it didn't happen at the same time, and silver went to $50, that's when the ratio was 30. And I think we're going to get back there at least, but we probably will go down to the historical average of 15, and it could maybe overshoot to 10 also. So I think silver now, I think the risk is lower. I still would recommend that if you're not a speculator or prepared to take big risk and ride the massive roller coaster that silver is, because yes, it will go up a lot faster, but when it corrects, you will have real problems living with it. So have a much smaller proportion of silver, and you're likely to make more money on the silver than on gold in the next few years. And at some point, I think you should actually change. When the ratio goes down to 30 or 20 or 10, maybe you change some of it over to gold. That's how we look at it.
Interesting, Igor. One of the other points from the Dark Years Are Coming presentation that really stood out to me is that you were saying that China has forecasted the US collapse basically since the Nixon era, right? And we've seen China stockpiling a lot of gold. So how do you think their role will change in this coming world?
Yes, China has a lot of gold. They're officially announcing just over 2,000 tons. So, and Russia also. And you know, we observers of market observers or precious metals think that they probably have a lot more, and that China could maybe has probably over 20,000 tons of gold. And I saw a recent article, but I don't know if that is true or not. But Jim Willey saying that actually both China and Russia have 100,000 ounces each. So I think I have no idea. That can't be verified in any way, but they most likely have more gold than they have declared. But, you know, let's go back to economic reality. China, in the last 50 years, since 1970 or 72, Nixon took the gold backing away. You know, the US GDP in the last 50 years has gone up 20 times in nominal terms, 20 times only. And Chinese GDP has gone up 175 times. So we can see what's happening. Sure, if we get an economic downturn, China has got massive debt also, and they will suffer like everybody else. But their debt is mainly domestic, so therefore they will cope with it as long as there's not a revolution in China. And then China, you know, whatever happens in the rest of the world and to their export markets, et cetera, they have a massive domestic economy that will make China prosper for years to come once the crisis is over. So, and of course, and then their currency is also going to be not backed by gold, but they have a bigger gold holding most probably than any other country. The U.S. allegedly is supposed to have 8,000 tons. I don't think they have, because I think that a lot of that has been probably leased to the market. And you lease to the market means that they're lending the gold to earn some money via the bullion banks, the banks trading gold. And in the old days, that gold used to stay in London with the bullion banks, physically stay there. But now the big buyers are China primarily, and also India, of course, are always buying. So now that gold is gone from London and has gone to China, and that's never going to get back. So if they have leased a major part of their gold out, or if they have sold it covertly, they're not going to get it back. So in my view, the actual position of the U.S. is probably a lot less than the 8,000 tons, a lot less. So therefore, I'm quite convinced that China, together with Russia, they're the ones who are going to have the power in coming years. And of course, Russia's debt situation is a lot better than the rest of the world's also. And they're used to suffering, Russia. They're used to suffering, the people also. So they will cope with the downturn, and they will come out as the stronger nations. While, you know, the West has been in decline for decades now. And of course, we've also seen that, you know, all the gold in the world has gradually gone from West to East, and that's continuing, because the West has still not understood the importance of gold, but the East does. And it's not only China, it's the whole of the East. You know, as I said, it is India, it's Vietnam, it's all of these countries in the East. So yeah, it's going to be a big shift in the world. You know, where we reach the now the point when the West is going to decline faster, sadly. We are at the height of decadence in the West now, just like at the fall of the Roman Empire. And that will have consequences, unfortunately.
It will, Egon. Obviously, you know, nobody looks forward to it, and we hope we're wrong, but hopefully this information can help some people really understand it a little bit better about what's coming. As you're talking about how much gold, you know, the US has and China has and stuff like that, you and I were talking a little bit before the call about your guys' mountain vault, and it's the biggest gold vault in the world. So could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. So we have a vault in the Swiss Alps, which is the biggest private gold vault in the world. And it's a vault that is ultra secure. It's nuclear bomb proof, earthquake proof, gas attack proof. It's got, you know, a big number of security zones, one after the other, that you have to go through to reach the gold. And it can only be opened, not just by the people of the vault, but also by two hidden security centers somewhere in Switzerland and that nobody knows where they are. So it's ultra secure. You cannot break into it. And it's going in there is a real James Bond experience. So if you want to, I'm going to give you a link. I don't know if you'll put it up or not. I'll give you a link so that when Grant Williams and I, because I showed Grant Williams the vault, and when we confidentially, because we can't see where it is or anything, but when we walk through parts of the vault, not where the gold actually is, but on the route to the gold, if you want. So that is, that is very unique. And that is for bigger investors, for investors of over $5 million. So then we have vaults in Zurich and Singapore where we are where the minimum is $400,000. So we cater for bigger investors. I mean, but we work with other companies who also have smaller investors, accept smaller investors, because gold is for everybody. We just happen to have a model which suits the bigger investors. But, you know, some people say, well, why can't you help us? But you know, it's just so there are other people helping smaller investors. And of course, you know, you can buy a gram of gold a month. Let's say a gram of gold is $65, mm-hmm. or you can buy, of course, an ounce of silver for $25 plus a bit of a premium, of course. It's precious metals is not just for the wealthy; it's for everybody. And it's just that we happen to cater for a certain category of investors. But really, is everybody should, instead of buying that, well, you don't. You know, buying Starbucks coffee, and well, most people don't buy that now because they don't get access to it. But nevertheless, gold is relatively, if you buy it in small amounts, it's so cheap. And if the people, for example, in Venezuela had done that, you know, that would have saved them if they'd done that 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We are likely to get the same situation. So at whatever level you can afford, buy a little bit of gold and silver now and keep it safe somewhere. I mean, the other area which is going to grow dramatically, in my view, is institutional buying of gold and silver. The institutions have to, especially gold, institutions will have to inflation protect their assets as inflation starts going up. And therefore, they have average less than 0.5% in gold now. And they are going to start buying gold. And we saw the first step with, Warren Buffett bought for $600 million and the Ohio Police Pension Fund bought 5% of their assets, which is about $800 million in gold. So they're starting. It's going to start. And that's going to be a big market. And there is not enough gold in the world to supply the institutions. Even 0.5% of all the investment gold in the world represents $2.5 trillion. That's all. 0.5% is $2.5 trillion. That's nothing. And that's all the investment gold available. It was not even available because that's already taken. Investors already hold that. So, and there's no more gold available. And very little is produced every year relative to demand. So therefore, the only way to meet future demand of gold is through higher prices, not through bigger quantities. And that's what's going to happen. That's what's going to push gold prices up.
So do we know, Egon, yet if the Ohio Pension Fund is trying to back that or buy physical, or are they buying ETFs? Did we get any clarification on that yet?
No, I haven't got the side story of that. I think that they initially, like everybody intending to buy anything in financial markets, were going through the conventional channels, i.e. futures or ETFs, et cetera. And of course, I've written about ETFs, that ETFs, they don't have the gold. And if they do, the investors don't have access to it, et cetera. So You know, you shouldn't hold gold in at all within the financial system in any form at all. You should. The whole purpose of a wealth preservation asset is wealth protection and insurance, and therefore it must be held outside the banking system where you have direct access to your own gold. So I don't know what they've done, but hopefully they're wise enough to realize that they should have. They have most of their assets, of course, within the system, but at least when they buy wealth preservation assets, they should have it outside. Mm-hmm.
So, Egon, as an educational tool, we can find more about your ideas on wealth preservation at goldswitzerland.com, correct?
Yeah.
And also at goldswitzerland on Twitter, correct?
Yes, absolutely. But it's more on the websites, some on Twitter. But and of course, on the website, there are a lot of articles and interviews, which, you know, really talks about all these things that I have been talking about today and a lot more, of course.
Yep, absolutely. Egon, thanks very much for your time today.
Tom, I really enjoyed it. You're doing a great job for people, educating them, and it's a privilege to be on your show. Thanks very much.
Thank you. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?